Hello, and welcome to the Luna's Reading Corner podcast, where we bring your questions to your favorite authors. I'm your host, Lacey Lawaji, and New Moon Girls member Julia joined me when we chatted with Nicole Pantelikos. Nicole is the author of Planet Earth is Blue, which is about Nova, a non-verbal girl on the autism spectrum who is eagerly awaiting the 1986 launch of the Space Shuttle Challenger. We talked to Nicole about her book and her life as a writer. Let's listen to what she has to say. I really want to thank you for chatting with us today, Nicole. The members of New Moon Girls who have read Planet Earth is Blue have been really moved by it. And we are going to break with form a little bit and talk about the ending later on, because it's something that the members who read the book really wanted to hear more about and kind of process, I think. We'll keep most of the discussion spoiler-free, and then at the end I'll sort of give a warning about when we're heading into spoiler territory, and then girls who don't want to know about the ending can stop listening at that point.
Okay, cool.
So we're going to start out with some general questions about your life as a writer, and then we'll go into more specific questions about your first novel and sort of your particular writing path. So in general, what inspires your story ideas?
The littlest thing can spark an idea. With Planet Earth is Blue, it was really the song Space Oddity by David Bowie, which is where the title comes from. I have a work in progress that I got the idea for when I was visiting a gangster museum in Hot Springs, like an old-timey gangster museum, and I got an idea. Sometimes I'll be reading an old newspaper article or driving. A lot of times I'm driving and I'll just see something that leads to something else that leads to something else, and before I know it, I've missed my exit on the highway because I'm so. Really, inspiration can be found anywhere.
So, what do you like best about writing, and what do you like the least?
I suppose the thing that I like best about writing is that I get so many ideas, and I enjoy being able to put them down on paper, or nowadays more to type them up and to get them like out of my head and into something else. And then
and
I love
to be really satisfying. It's like getting your ideas out into the world. It can feel really satisfying. So yeah, I get that.
Yes. And I love feedback too. So once it gets to that process, even when I was a teenager, I wrote a lot of fan fiction and I would put it up online, and I loved seeing how it would resonate with different people who read it. And I just love sharing my ideas. So it's a lot of fun. I suppose the thing I like the least would be, there's usually a point, so I tend to start off very quickly, and I write the beginning, and I'm really excited about it, and then I write the end, and I'm really excited about it, and then there's that, like, daunting middle that I have to go back and fill in. So it's not so much that I dislike it, but that can be the hardest and the most tedious. And if I lose a story, like if I lose the motivation for a story or the muse, it tends to happen then when I'm in that murky middle.
Yeah, like, I totally get that too, because I'm trying to write something myself, and that's pretty much exactly what's happening.
The middle is kind of a sticking point for a lot of writers. Do you write your stories out of order, Nicole? Like, do you write the beginning first and then write the ending, or do you write them straight through?
No, sometimes I write them straight through, but most of the time I write the ending before I write the middle.
Wow.
So I write maybe the first anywhere from like 2 to 5 chapters of the beginning, and then I go write the middle. The middle will change sometimes a little bit, sometimes a lot, as I work on the middle.
Mm-hmm.
But I like to know where I'm ending up before I try to get there. So I do write the last, sometimes the last chapter, sometimes the last like 3 chapters maybe. Before I go back and then start from chapter 6, and then I just need chapter 6 through almost the end, and then I'm good.
That's a really cool process. I imagine it would like relieve a little bit of anxiety to know where your destination is, even if you don't know exactly how you're going to get there.
Yes, that's what I like. And then you can find little ways to hint at things for the ending, especially with something like Planet Earth is Blue, mm-hmm. which, no spoilers, I won't get into it yet, but because there is so much going on at the ending, I mm-hmm. needed to know where I was going to end up before I got there. Otherwise, I feel like when I wrote the story, I would have meandered all over the place.
Yeah, when I got to the ending, I kind of noticed that. Like, there were little things that I didn't notice before, but they were kind of leading up to that ending.
So, in addition to writing, what other jobs have you had?
Well, in high school and college, I worked on an ice cream truck, which was actually one of my favorite jobs. It was a lot of fun. I worked with my friends, and we spent the summer just selling and eating a ton of ice cream.
Nice.
I shouldn't even say that, though, because by the end of the summer, none of us wanted to see ice cream again until the next year. So I had that job. I did a lot of babysitting. I worked as a nanny after I was in college and beyond. I worked in public school. I worked in a couple of autism programs. And for 1 month, I worked at a fast food restaurant in high school.
So what were your favorite books when you were a kid?
When I was a kid, I loved The Babysitter's Club. I know kids now read the graphic novel versions. They didn't have graphic novels, so I read the original Babysitter's Club, and I loved them. I read all of them. I think I started reading them around first grade, and I continued reading them up until, a few years ago. I found one at a used bookstore I'd never read before, so I read that one. So I guess I still say I'm still reading The Babysitter's Club.
I've read the graphic novels, and I've also read about 5, I think, of the originals. I like them. So aren't there, like, 200 or more?
That's a lot.
Yeah, there's hundreds, because there's all the mysteries and super specials. My favorites were the super mysteries because they were a lot longer than the other books, and they had chapters from everybody's point of view. Sometimes they would even have chapters from, like, the book point of view or from the kids that they babysat, and they were always mysteries. Those were the best, and I used to drive my father a little batty because I would talk about, as a younger kid, the babysitters said, like, they were people, mm-hmm. and we had a rule at dinner that you couldn't talk about book people, only real people, so I would talk about them, but I take some details so it sounded like they were real people. It was definitely, like, a bit of an obsession before.
Yeah,
definitely.
And it was pre-Harry Potter. After Harry Potter came out, I felt like there were more kids having the same experience like that, with kids really, really into Harry Potter and becoming fully immersed in the world. And that was exciting for me to see others feeling that way, too.
Yeah.
I think, a lot of kids clearly loved Babysitter's Club. They sold really well for, 20 years, but I'm not sure that kids were, like, cosplaying the BSC.
So how did you decide that Planet Earth is Blue is the story that you wanted to tell? And why did you decide on setting it in the lead-up to the Challenger launch in 1986? And since that was, like, a famously failed launch, because it exploded, I mean, like, why did you want to tell that story that time?
My very first idea for Planet Earth is Blue was about an autistic girl in foster care who's obsessed with the disaster. So originally it was going to take place many years later, and she's obsessed with old news footage and things like that. And I got that idea because I, as a kid, was very much obsessed with things like extreme weather and terrible things happening on the news. I remember being about 9 when the Oklahoma City bombing happened, and I couldn't stop watching TV. I would sit and take notes watching the news because I didn't want to miss or forget anything until eventually my parents were like, this is not healthy. No more Oklahoma City bombing. So I wanted to write a book about a kid who has that sort of obsession. But as I started to try and come up with ideas, before I even wrote a single chapter, I did a lot of, taking walks and listening to music and brainstorming. And I always try and get a good idea of a character and their voice before I start writing. And I hadn't found it yet. And one day I was listening to Space Oddity. I went for a walk, and I was listening to Space Oddity, And the song starts with so much hope about this astronaut who's going into space. And then it ends with, planet Earth is blue and there's nothing I can do because it goes wrong and he can't fix it. And the more I listened to that song, the more I thought about that as a better vehicle for the book. So instead of having a kid who's obsessed with a terrible thing that already happened, have a kid who's obsessed with something wonderful that's going to happen and have all this hope, and then go into what happens when this thing that you've hoped for and looked forward to and attached yourself to for so long doesn't work out, because there are a lot of problems that we have in our lives or that we're going to have that you just can't fix. And I decided that that was a better story, especially for tween and teen readers who may not have had that experience yet, because when a lot of, you know, the problems that you read in younger books, especially stuff like The Babysitter's Club, which I love, it always has an ending where everything is fixed and life doesn't work. Okay?
So you did actually talk about, I was going to ask you to talk a little bit about where the title of the books comes from, but you did talk a lot about the song and how that those are some of the closing lines. Did you want to say anything else about the title?
Not that I can think of. I just love it. It's such a brilliant song, and I hope that people who like the book who haven't heard it will listen to it and see the parallels between the two. And then I also hope that readers can relate to being so obsessed with a song. I am the type of person, from the time I was a very little kid and I had a record player, if I liked a song, I would keep starting it over and listening to it over and over and over again, not just to enjoy it, but to like process it and to really understand it. And that's what Nova does. So I hope others can relate to that.
I'm curious, Julia, have you heard Space Oddity before?
Yeah. I always thought it was a really sad song because I knew how it was going to end.
Yeah.
Actually, I think the first time I heard it was when my mom was reading aloud to me a different book. I think it was Wonderstruck, and one of the characters liked that song, and so she pulled it up for me. And so when I showed her this book, I showed her the summary, and she started singing that song.
I was with my mother in the car the first time I heard it, and she was like, oh, you have to listen to this song. When it got to the end and it, like, you know, Major Tom is like floating and says planet Earth is blue and there's nothing I can do, I could not handle that at that time. I was like, what do you mean there's nothing he could do? How is he going to get back? What's going to happen to him? And she was like, it's just, I love my mother, but she does not obsess over things like I do. She was like, it's just a song. And then she went to like Elton John. I was like, what do you mean it's just a song?
And then he's talking about like, he's talking about telling his wife and family goodbye. And yeah, it's so sad.
Yes, I could not handle it. I went online to try and find more information. I was like, there has to be a sequel. There is a response song called Mrs. Major Tom.
Really?
That Cheryl sings. Yeah. Which is, it's really lovely, but it doesn't bring Major Tom back to Earth. Spoiler alert. So.
All right. So I thought your portrayal of Nova was really well done, and I believe it's really important to have positive representations of neurodiversity and different abilities in books, and I think you did that really well. But this brings me to her school friends, some of them, specifically Alex, Luke, Thomas, and Margaret. They aren't in the book a whole lot. I think that's how you pronounce her name. They aren't in the book a whole lot, but I really like their characters. So do you have any more information about them? Because they were really interesting.
Thank you. I really enjoyed creating her class. I can't remember seeing too many other middle grade books where, or just books in general, where the character has a lot of friends who also have varying diagnoses. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to show a realistic classroom for her with a lot of friends. So I did write up information more about most of the kids that, you know, won't end up going anywhere because I couldn't fit a backstory for each kid in the book. But going down the lines, there's Alex. Alex is the sweet boy who first invites her to play. And Alex has Down syndrome. Matt Lurie, who's the girl who helps her out helps you out depending on how you look at it. In the,
yeah.
The class.
I thought the cookie burning scene was pretty funny.
So she's Mallory's people on the autism spectrum. Oh, Margot is the young girl who's in a wheelchair, mm-hmm. and she has Rett syndrome or Rett disorder. I don't think, as of the time that the book takes place, that that had been identified yet. I'm not sure what they would have said for her diagnosis in that time period, but that's what I was thinking. That was my, I think Luke might have Down syndrome too, but I don't have my notes in front of me, so I do not remember. Oh, Buddy, bouncing boy Buddy in her classroom is also autistic. But I enjoyed creating them, and I wrote up little backstories for each of them about, like, this is where they live, and this is who they live with, and I came up with more stuff about the characters she spends more time with, like Alex mm-hmm. and Mallory, and then just some basic things about the kids that she doesn't see so much because they're older, or she doesn't mm-hmm. end up hanging out with them too much. But I did have a fun time kind of picturing each of them and coming up with how they could play independent games together without having to worry too much about using speech or writing or the things that some of them would find more challenging.
I loved sort of the diversity of the characters in her class, and I love hearing you talk about them, Nicole, because that is something that as a reader and as an adult reader, which my experience is a little different than middle grade or, teen or tween readers who are reading it, I found myself wondering, like, about their diagnoses. And I kind of like that you didn't ever make them explicit in the book because, for one thing, I think that's something, you know, Nova wouldn't have known, but also I think it's important not to reduce people to, you know, what their
right.
official diagnosis is. So I appreciate hearing you talk about them and your sort of intentions for what you were portraying with each of the character. But I think that it was wise to not go into the official diagnoses within the book. So it's kind of nice to be able to have sort of have it both ways.
Yeah.
Thank you. That's what I'm trying for. I wanted her friends to be just her friends. They're mm-hmm. in her specialized classroom, but they're just her friends. So I think reading it, it's probably obvious that it's probably obvious that Buddy is autistic from mm-hmm. the page, but maybe less so about, you know, Margot or Mallory. But for mm-hmm. me, the more important things that you know is, like, Mallory, you know, has a little bit of a, not quite a mean streak, but sort of a naughty streak.
Yeah.
And she's not going to let anybody hurt her friends, which I had fun with. And it's important to know that Margot really responds to music and she loves to listen, and that she does connect with Nova, even though they can't have a verbal conversation with each other. So mm-hmm. plus, like you said, Nova wouldn't know. It's not like Nova's going to go and read their files. So
yeah.
she doesn't. And it doesn't matter. Nova. They're her friends, and that's what matters.
So why did you decide to make Nova nonverbal, and how did you deal with some of the storytelling challenges that presented? And before you go into that, you might want to explain exactly what that means for readers, you know, our listeners who may not have encountered that term before.
Okay, so nonverbal, or now I'm seeing a lot of people using non-speaking instead of nonverbal, or verbally apraxic, or, you know, apraxy of speech. These are all terms for someone like Nova who is primarily not able to communicate using speech. Mm-hmm. She talks some. The apraxia means that it's difficult for her to enunciate words. It's difficult for her to say the word that she means to say. And it's difficult for her because if she does try to speak, a lot of times people won't understand, and then it becomes frustrating because she's doing her best, and not everyone is always doing their best to listen. So she mostly does not speak. Mm-hmm. If she were in school nowadays, the hope would be that she would be able to use a tablet sort of program where mm-hmm. she could push pictures or words, and then it would speak, and she could communicate that way, and people would better understand her. For the 80s, it was very isolating, and mm-hmm. there was this pervasive belief from some people that still is around with some people today, which is shocking and sad, considering I feel people should know better, but some people think that if somebody can't talk, they don't think, they're not mm-hmm. thinking. And when I was working on first writing Nova and her voice, I had previously written a non-verbal character in something else, and the more I was working on coming up with Nova's inner voice, the more I was feeling that that maybe her inner voice was not being heard by the people around her. And I was specifically thinking about, I don't want to give too much personal detail, but I have several nonverbal people in my family, including several children on the autism spectrum, but also at the time my grandmother was experiencing verbal apraxia. She had vascular dementia and was losing her speech, and she would say the wrong word or not be able to say a word, and it was very frustrating. But what I noticed more than her speech was how people were suddenly changing how they spoke to her. Mm-hmm. So she's a very intelligent woman who had always talked, you know, a lot, and then all of a sudden people are talking to her in an infantilized way, which I would see mm-hmm. with the kids in my life all the time too. And I was like, this is not okay. So I decided mm-hmm. with my character, I would show that and also show both the right and the wrong way to communicate. So for example, the principal talks to her like every word starts with a capital letter mm-hmm. and very low and sort of like with watered down basic sentences. And she's looking at him like, are you serious? Mm-hmm. Whereas somebody like Mallory or her sister Bridget just talks to her. They just do. And I really wanted to have a character who was having that experience, not only for kids like those nonverbal kids that I know who don't see themselves so much in books or don't see themselves in a positive way. There are some books with characters who don't speak, but they're not always portrayed in the most positive way. And also for other kids to see, like, just because one of your peers may not speak much or may have trouble getting words out if they do speak or may use a communication device, it doesn't mean they're not thinking. It doesn't mean they're creative. It doesn't mean they don't have a lot to say.
So I know that you've worked with kids on the autism spectrum, and in your afterword you talked about how some of Nova's characteristics and experiences were based on your own childhood. And I was wondering, what were some of the other ways that you prepared to write from a perspective that, as you've mentioned, is rarely seen in fiction?
So I was nervous because I didn't want to... There's this saying, like, if you've met one person with autism, you've met one person. And mm-hmm. it's very true. And I read a lot of middle grade novels and other books with autistic protagonists. And individually, most of them are great books. But when you put them together, they paint a picture of one very specific type of kid. Mm-hmm. And that very specific type of kid has really become a stereotype in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to get away from that. The biggest stereotype I wanted to combat is that people on the autism spectrum aren't creative or imaginative. Mm-hmm. I'll never forget, there was maybe 12 years ago, I was playing with one of my godchildren at his school. And there was a woman there who is an autism expert. She's what's called a board-certified behavior analyst. So this is her job. And he was galloping around like he was on a horse and whinnying. And I said something about he's always pretending to be farm animals. His grandparents have farm. And she goes, oh, he's not pretending. Autistic kids can't do that. He doesn't have the capacity for the nation. And I was like, are you serious? Like, he pretends all the time. And she said, no, he's imitating. It's not the same. And I remember being just afraid that I'm like, you're supposed to be here to help him, but you don't even think he has an imagination. He's like the most imaginative kid I know. And that, like, if you, there's a lot of articles being written now about girls on the autism spectrum who have gone undiagnosed. And part of it is because of that pervasive belief that if you are creative or if you are daydreaming, that unless you're daydreaming about, like, prime numbers and very dry science facts, uh-huh. that you must not be autistic. As a kid, I was always stuck in my daydream world, and I would have a very hard time coming out of it. Mm-hmm. And I'm talking, that was just in the past. But as I already said, like, I will drive by 3 or 4 exits on the highway before I realize that I'm not where I'm supposed to be, which probably yeah. makes it sound like I should be driving, but I swear I pay attention. But lost in that imagination more so than the average kid, and Nova is the same way, and it's hard for her to come out of it. Mm-hmm. And I would see that a lot with kids, and I wanted to make that really on the page. And one of my favorite responses I've gotten from a reader so far, I was at a fourth grade, I was doing a fourth grade school visit, and a boy raised his hand, and he said, it was like someone sucked him right out of my hopes and dreams and put him on the floor in front of me, because he raised his hand she said, I'm so-and-so, I'm autistic, and I love that she uses her imagination, because I use my imagination on the bus every single morning before school, and I've never seen that in a book. And I was like, I could have cried. I was like, oh, you exist, you're right here, you're perfect. I think I got a little off topic. I got distracted because I'm really passionate about that, and I forgot the original question. I'm so sorry.
No, that I think that's I really appreciate you talking about that, especially in terms of, you know, the representation of autistic kids in children's literature right now. But the question was about, you know, the ways that you prepared to write from that perspective, and I think that you did kind of answer that. But if there's more that you want to say, you know, go ahead.
I remember where I was originally going to go with where I started. So I was going to say I wanted to be careful not to fall into that stereotype. So I tried to read and study and talk to as many other people as I knew, because I didn't want to put just my perspective or just something based on the kids that I spend the most time with. And I had several sensitivity readers who are on the spectrum, including those who are either primarily nonverbal now or were as a child, to try and help to make sure I had as well-rounded a character as I could. So I hope that answers it a little bit more.
Yeah, and just for our listeners who might not have encountered the term sensitivity readers, that's just when you give your draft to someone who's had experiences similar to what you're trying to portray, right? And they give you feedback on that aspect of it.
Yeah.
So I saw that you're also a playwright, which is really cool. So could you tell us about some of the performance things that you've written?
Sure. So most of my plays are very much not for kids. I write a lot of psychological sort of drama, things that are pretty dark. But I've also written... one of my favorites was I wanted to direct an adaptation of Alice in Wonderland, and I kept searching and searching for a script, and I couldn't find something very close to the original stories of Alice and Through the Looking Glass, so I ended up creating my own, and that was a lot of fun. Since then, a few other schools, I directed it at a community theater, but it's been done at several schools now, and I've done a lot of Shakespeare adaptations to take Shakespeare and put it into like a modern context, or to take characters from different shows. One of my favorites that has been done at a couple of high schools was one where I have Lady Macbeth and her husband are throwing a party, and they invite characters from all different Shakespeare plays, and it's the night that Romeo meets Juliet, and it's the night that Julius Caesar gets stabbed, and all of these fun things from his plays happen.
That sounds really interesting.
Yeah, it's kind of cool mashup.
Yeah, so that was a lot of fun for me to do. Actually working right now on an adaptation of A Christmas Carol for the same reason. A friend and I are going to direct it next year, and we couldn't find an adaptation we really liked, so we're making our own.
So how does the writing process compare for you between writing plays and writing novels?
Writing a play, I definitely don't write the ending first. I just sit down, it's straight dialogue. I don't even write, most of the time I don't even write any blocking or stage direction or anything. I just sit down and write dialogue till I get to, for a short play, I write straight through till I get to the end. Usually for a full length, I'll write until I get tired, and then I pick it up again and pick it up again later. With an adaptation, though, I know the ending ahead of time because it's already done. But for an original work, especially, I write a lot of short plays that last when performed between 10 minutes and a half an hour, depending on what their purpose is. And a lot of times I won't even name characters. I have a lot of plays where the characters are named man and woman or ABC. Like there's one A, then there's B, and then there's C. And sometimes I'll go back in and I'll fill in names later. But I do have actually produced shows that the characters are named A and B or her and she or man and woman. And those are some of the more, I think, more interesting ones because you don't have any sort of, you get a lot from a person when you hear their name, whether you're supposed to or not. So I like taking that away.
So what is your editing process like?
Oh, gosh, messy. I I usually will give things to casual readers first to get an idea. A lot of times when I've written those first five chapters, while I'm working on the ending, I'll ask people to read the first five chapters and just give me a very general, like, how do you feel? Are you hooked? Is this something you would read? Are there any characters that are compelling? So I can get an idea if I'm on the right track. Depending on what they say, I might go back and change things before I jump into the middle. A lot of it is just going back through and rereading over and over again and saying, maybe this doesn't need to be here, and then I always keep a Word document open of cut scenes or cut lines. So as I'm going, I might say, like, I love these two lines. They're great, but I don't need them right here. And I'll take them and I'll put them on that other page. And then later I'll find a place for them, if there is a place for them. Now that I have an agent and editor, that has added, I skipped a step. I have a critique partner too. And she and I exchange work back and forth where we give each other a more thorough response. Mm-hmm. And then we edit based on what the other has said. I love getting questions from people who are reading. I'm in a critique group right now for a graduate school tutorial, and that's the big thing, is we ask each other questions, and you're not allowed to answer the questions in class. Mm-hmm. And it gets me thinking, because sometimes the answers I already have planned, but sometimes they ask questions and I'm like, I didn't even think of that as important, but now I have a new idea. And now that I have an agent and an editor, it goes to my agent. She makes big suggestions, and then I give it back. She makes little suggestions, goes to my editor. She does the same thing. She starts with an edit letter where she writes, these are all the things I like about this. These are the things I think we could look at more. These are the questions I had. And we go from there. So it always starts with sort of a broad edit, which is where you would say, like, I need to get rid of these characters. We had a couple of characters in Planet Earth is Blue who did not make it to the later revisions. And there's always, like, a moment at first where I'm like, but I need them, and you don't. And then as you get down, it gets into the nitpicky sort of things where, for example, I found out from one of the last people who read it during the editing process is there's a little play school toy astronaut that I had referred to throughout the book. And she pointed out that they didn't make an astronaut yet. And I was like, no, they had to, because I had him and I described what he looked like. And we looked him up online, and he's not an astronaut. He's a motorcycle man. So for 30 years, I thought I had an astronaut toy. I still have him at home. He's not even an astronaut. He's a motorcycle driver.
Wow.
So, we got into, like, the small editing, which I find that stuff fun, but for a tiny, weird, sentimental part of me, it was like, I was playing with him ROM for all those years. But
well, that's what imagination's for, right?
Yeah. So basically with editing, I go from, like, the big edits to the small edits to the really, really, really small edits.
We have just a few more closing questions before we wrap up, and then we'll talk a little bit about the ending.
So are you working on anything novels now?
Yes. I usually have several things in the works at one time because I can't focus on just one. But my two right now that I'm most excited about, one takes place in 1933, the last year of Prohibition in America, down in Hot Springs, Arkansas, where a lot of the gangsters, like the old-timey gangsters, like the Al Capone types, would go on vacation. So I'm having a lot of fun with that, especially with researching the setting and the period. And then the one I started more recently that I'm super into right now, I just finished writing the ending, and now I'm working on the middle, takes place in 1978 in New England, and is about, I don't want to give too much away, but it's about a blizzard and a group of kids. It's a lot of fun for me as a writer.
Are the books, are they middle grade or young adult books?
They're both middle grade. Currently, for novels, all I'm writing is middle grade.
So what advice do you have for young writers?
There's so much good advice out there that people give. But for me, I would say the number one thing is to just keep writing. The worst thing for me is if I start an idea and it's going really well, and then I put it aside and say I'll get to it later, because a lot of times I won't get to it later, unless it's something where I have multiple projects at a time, so I'm going back to each one regularly. Mm-hmm. But the best thing, it doesn't have to be good. A lot of times when I was younger, I would get hung up on, especially with writing a play, I'd get hung up on writing perfection the first time, and I've since learned that there's no such thing as perfection the first time. So if you write it the first time and it's not perfect, keep working on it, keep rewriting it, have other people read it. having other readers and people to respond is, to me, so valuable. So if you're, you know, in high school or middle school and you can start or join a writing club, that's great. You can share your work with a group of people. And then if through that writing club, you can find like one friend to be your critique partner. My critique partner and I, she writes young adult. We used to meet at cafes a couple times a week and we would talk for a little while and then we'd just work. And then we'd take breaks to ask each other about our projects and then we'd exchange work to read while we were not together. I think kids at any age can do that, and it's so invaluable to have someone else reading your work. And you you have to take criticism. You have to learn to take criticism and also learn when to dismiss someone else's idea. But the best thing when you're starting out is to have that critique partner who will tell you all the things they like and ask you questions. And that's the best kind of critique partner you can be for another writer, is to tell them what's going right and then ask them about whatever you're wondering, as opposed to saying, well, this doesn't work for me, because you could say, well, why did you do it this way? And just, it's, writing can be a really solitary thing, but if you find your group or your person, it's a much better process, and I feel like you're more likely to get things done, or at least I am.
It's like peer editing, because at my school, like I just graduated from middle school at the beginning of June. In 7th and 8th grade, we would do a lot, we would do a writing project every quarter, sometimes more than one, and our teachers, like, it was a really small classroom, so our teachers would have us choose someone to peer edit us. I always thought it was really annoying because there was so much other stuff I had to do, but it actually was really beneficial because I could see what my classmates thought of my writing, what I could change. Usually I didn't really get too many edits, but also it was an opportunity for me to look at their work and tell them what they did well, what they could work on, and it made me feel helpful.
I remember doing peer edits in school, and I, like you, did not like them at that time. but one of the things I like about them was that a lot of times the person would feel, I think, looking back, would feel pressured to put edits the way a teacher does and correct things that don't need to be corrected. And I used to get frustrated if I'd get something back and someone would correct my grammar and they were wrong, because then it's irritating. So it is like peer editing, but you want to find the right person or people who aren't going to try too hard to do it like a teacher would, because you you don't edit creative writing the way you do a lot of the stuff that you're going to do in school. Like I said, it's important to find someone who's going to focus on the good things and how to make it better, as opposed to, you know, do you really think you need a comma here? It's like, it doesn't matter. I don't care. Commas are not important at this stage. So, yeah, so it's a little like that, but finding the people who work right for you.
Now we are going to get into spoiler territory. So if you're listening and you haven't read Planet Earth is Blue, you can stop listening now. A discussion about the book's ending will follow, and there will be no additional questions for Nicole afterwards. So if you stop listening now, you don't have to worry that you're going to miss something else. Usually we try to keep our podcasts mostly spoiler-free, but in this case, members who had read the book felt pretty strongly about discussing it, and we had a few questions about it. So a lot of times, like, when the same question comes up multiple times, I'm like, okay, we do need to talk to the author about this. Julia, do you want to talk a little bit about your reaction to the ending and then the questions that you had?
Yeah. Okay, so for anyone who wasn't listening, I'm serious. Spoilers. Why did you kill off Bridget before Nova lands with her new foster family? Because I was not expecting that. Like, I kind of had a suspicion, but I didn't think it was actually going to happen, because it was really heartbreaking to see all these letters she was writing, especially as she was forgetting little things about Bridget, like her eye color, and not knowing that she would never see them. And Nova was looking forward to seeing the space launch with her as well, and Bridget wouldn't have been able to see it with her. And also, as it exploding, that whole sequence of events must have been really so painful. But the ending, the very end pages of her getting past the pain and knowing that she'll be okay was really powerful in that context as well. Can you talk about that decision?
I will say, I had a very hard time deciding where Bridget was. And in early versions of my head before I'd written the ending, before I'd written it down, when I was still just going for walks and listening to Space Oddity and trying to figure out the pieces of this puzzle, I thought, like, maybe she's in a juvenile detention center. Maybe mm-hmm. she broke the law. Maybe she really did run away. But I felt, the more I thought about Bridget, it was like she wouldn't leave Nova. I couldn't picture mm-hmm. her actually leaving and not contacting her. She does mm-hmm. say, you know, I'll come back for you. But to have no communication, I was like, there has to be something very, very wrong for her mm-hmm. to, because I can't picture how she could do that knowing everything we know about her. So I kept thinking about it, and I kept listening to Space Oddity. And eventually one day I was out for a walk in the middle of the night listening to music, and I thought the only way she wouldn't have come back for Nova is if she can't, because she's dead. Mm-hmm. And I felt really bad about it, but the more that I thought about it, it sort of mirrors the song. Like, she's like, Bridget and Nova are both like Major Tom in different ways. Bridget is gone and there's nothing that can be done about that. Also, I feel like if Bridget was there, Nova wouldn't be able to have that other family, because Bridget would always be keeping her from it. So she wouldn't be adopted by them if Bridget were, say, in a juvenile detention center. Or one person mm-hmm. who read it suggested, they said, what if she's in a nursing home because she got into an accident and she'll never leave? And I feel like that in some ways is more depressing than what mm-hmm. happened. Like, so I didn't want to do something like that. So I felt guilty because I felt like it was a lot of extra pain for Nova. But mm-hmm. the more I thought about it, the more I liked this idea of, my agent calls it like the lies we tell ourselves, mm-hmm. and having an narrator. And like, Nova knows that her sister has died, but at the same time, Nova knows that her sister doesn't lie to her and promise mm-hmm. to come back. So mm-hmm. she's still always expecting that to happen. And it's when she sees the explosion and realizes, like, sometimes you just don't get what you want no matter how much you want it, that she's finally mm-hmm. able to accept and process, this is what happened to my sister and she can't come back.
I thought it was like a repressed memory sort of situation in that sense. I thought she was repressing her memories of the accident because she was just hoping so much that her sister would come back, she was mm-hmm. thinking she was really alive.
It could be. It could definitely be read like that. The thought that I was having was more about, as a kid, I was told that my great-grandmother had died, and I was told that meant, I was told she wouldn't be coming back, and I was like, okay, I understand, I get it, yes, I'm sad. And it wasn't until her husband, who's my step-great-grandfather, until I managed to get him alone for something, that I asked him to tell me the truth about, like, where she was and when she was coming back. And he was like, she died. And I was like, I know she died, but when is she coming back? Mm-hmm. So there's this sort of disconnect that I also gave to Nova. So, like, if something is so traumatic and you haven't had that experience before, there's this disconnect between knowing that someone is gone but also not really being able to grasp that someone is gone. But there mm-hmm. is a repressory element to it, because she has been purposely suppressing the memories of the accident. Like, when they drive by the accident site and Francine and Joni have showed her the cross, mm-hmm. she turns it off in her brain. She shuts it right down because she's not ready to process that. And she's a little annoyed that they're even doing that. So she mm-hmm. shuts it right. So she hasn't, it's not a repressed memory in the sense that, like, sometimes somebody will be, you know, 40 and in therapy and remember something that happened as a child that they've completely forgotten. For mm-hmm. her, it's more like she's in the process of purposely repressing that memory mm-hmm. so that she doesn't have to let it interfere with her hope that Bridget's coming back.
It was traumatic, but at the same time, you had enough lead up in the book. Like, I started to sort of get a hint when they were stopping at the cross, and I was like, okay, I think that Bridget has actually passed. So there were kind of enough clues, I think, to help prepare readers a little bit that whatever the ending was going to be, you know. And the silver lining, or the upside, is that now Nova can begin to really process it. And start to integrate that into her life, you know, going forward.
I did not pick up on the cross thing at all until I got to that part. I actually thought when Nova and Joni were driving by, I thought it was just some cross person who died, and Joni was talking about how we miss people, and I thought that meant Bridget was still alive. And also, like, right in the lead up before that reveal, when Nova's thinking that she has to go exactly to where she saw Bridget last, I thought she was at her boyfriend's house, because I did not want to go there.
I had sort of a similar reaction, Julia, where I sort of had an inkling, but I was like, oh, but I don't want it to be true.
Yeah.
So I definitely understand where you're coming from there.
Originally, that cross was not for Bridget and her boyfriend. Joni had a sister who had died in a car accident, and that was for her. And her parents took in Nova because they saw stuff about her in the paper, and she had lost Bridget on the same stretch of road that their daughter had died on, and that's one of the things that my editor was like, do we really need that? And when I looked at it, I was like, no. So she was instrumental in having it, having those scenes be the way that they ended up, being.
Well, as we promised our listeners, I'm not going to ask any other questions that they will miss out on if they stop listening already. So, all right, thank you so, so much, Nicole. I will let you go. Thank you also, Julia, for joining us. I really appreciate that you could be on the call. And I hope
Definitely.
That you both enjoy the rest of your weekend.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, both of you. Thanks.
Yep. Bye-bye.
Bye. Bye.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of the Luna's Reading Corner podcast. Make sure to visit Luna's Reading Corner on the New Moon Girls member site for even more book and reading related goodies. Until next time, happy reading.